Hello there and welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Neil Tracy with you, and apologies in advance if my voice goes at any stage in this podcast, coming through the far side of a bit of a head cold, but the podcast waits for nobody. I'm a brave soldier. I'm a king of content. Bernard Jackman is with me here today. Bernard, good to have you in studio as well. And back on the line, it's been a few weeks, but Johnny Holland, good to have you back with us as well.
Yeah, it's good to be back as a floating head. Been a few weeks, all right.
We were talking off air before we started. Good win at the weekend in terms of Cork Con against Young Munsters down in the Killing Fields in Limerick. They had a fairly loaded team.
Yeah, it was. I think both teams were at a good. Obviously, they got a lot of availability, and I saw a lot of stuff on Twitter about all their senior players. But they had a very good side, and we were 9 points down in the second half. So to come back from that was probably the bit that made it such a good win. But yeah, it was a cracking AIL game, to be fair.
As you said as well, it's a great place to win, an awful, awful place to lose.
Fact, yeah, terrible place to lose. But yeah, good win though, to be fair. And both sides needed to win, so to have a close game like that, I think it's just good for the league. You had players Josh Witcherly on one side of the scrum with Mark Donnelly on the other for us. They're good matchups. I know not directly head to head, but two good loose hits on the pitch, and Shane McCarthy in their backfield with Hubert Gilvary as well, not contracted, but they had danger all over the pitch. Evan O'Connell in the middle of their packs. It's good to see that kind of availability in the AIL because it's a good product.
Yeah, it really is. It's been great this season. It's starting to kind of take shape as we head towards the midpoint over the next couple of weeks. Bernard, before we start as well, I want to, and I'm sure you do as well, I want to give a big thanks to everyone for the reaction to last week's podcast, because it really was brilliant, the reaction and feedback we got to the big scrum special we did it with Mike Ross. Johnny was unavailable to join us for that, obviously. But I had a look back at the numbers, and going off YouTube specifically, it's actually our second most popular podcast ever. Okay. Off the YouTube numbers. Just shy of 56,000 at the moment, only on YouTube at the moment, but I wouldn't be surprised if that creeps up a little bit more. The most popular one we've ever done was the recap of the World Cup final. That South Africa one. So I'm sensing a team here.
Yeah.
And I'm jetting off next week to Open RT Sports Cape Town Bureau. So we'll be setting up a new podcast studio for there for the next couple of years leading up to the World Cup, I'm sure.
They are amazing fans, and they get a lot of criticism, and sometimes they can be quite one-eyed in terms. And John Smith was even, what did he call them, psychopaths or something. But they do engage. They absolutely love their rugby, and I got a lot of messages about it as well. It's just, obviously, it's so rare to break down that area of the game. And I think that's the thing about rugby. You don't want to make it too complicated that it's difficult for new fans to get involved. But a lot of the current fans do actually want to get under the bonnet of certain areas. And the scrum is probably the one that, unless you've played front row, probably bamboozles people the most. So having Rossi on was great. And obviously we had a game that the scrum played a huge role in. And even we saw follow on from that, the Stormers Munster. So at the moment, South African teams do seem to have a bit of an edge in that area, and the only way other countries or other teams can counteract that is by being technically and tactically very, very smart. Obviously, you've got to be strong and big as well, but if you're not on point technically, they're just exposing teams, and it's becoming the most compelling factor in winning or losing games.
Yeah, and it's nice to see as well that there's an audience out there for us, because I think too often you hear about the scrums are boring. Yeah. And all that sort of stuff. There is an audience out there for us, and I think there is an audience as well for a bit more in-depth stuff along the way. And I think maybe in a month or two's time, coming up around the Six Nations, if there's a big issue that crops up again in the game, it could be an attacking situation where we'll get Johnny in or something like that, and we could do a big proper deep dive again. So we'll keep an eye on doing some more of those things, because it's good to see there's an audience out there for some of the more niche stuff and more getting into the weeds of it. So we've got an interesting running order to get through today, plenty in it, starting obviously with the 2027 Rugby World Cup draw, which was made this morning. If you don't already know, you probably do now know by now, though, Ireland will face Scotland, Uruguay and Portugal in Pool D in the World Cup in Australia in 2 years' time. So if Ireland top their pool, crucially, they will face a third place finisher in the round of 16. If they get through that, it would be Argentina as the most likely quarterfinal opponent. The winner of Ireland's pool would crucially also remain on the opposite side of the draw to defending champions South Africa and New Zealand. But the important thing to remember then as well is finishing second in Pool D would come at a massive cost, because France would be the most likely opponents in the round of 16. And, you know, you don't want to do that. And if you get through that, possibly you're realistically you're taking on a Springboks or a New Zealand in a potential semi-final. They're on a collision course for the quarters as well, by the way. So it's shaping up fantastically. To quickly run through the pools, New Zealand, Australia, Chile and Hong Kong in Pool A. Pool B is South Africa, Italy, Georgia and Romania. Pool C, Argentina, Fiji, Spain, Canada. Ireland's Pool D, along with Scotland, Uruguay and Portugal. Pool E has France, Japan, USA and Samoa. And then the final pool, Pool F, England, Wales, Tonga, Zimbabwe. All in all, probably as good a draw as Ireland could have hoped for. Not necessarily because Scotland are the opponents or Uruguay or Portugal, but Ireland, they have a path that they can plot towards a potential semi-final. Although if you slip up, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, if you slip up, you're in big trouble. But realistically, with the new format of this World Cup and 24 teams and six groups, there's no real group of death anymore. Mm-hmm. Like the closest group to death is Pool C, which is Argentina ranked sixth and Fiji ranked eighth in general. And the other hard one, I would say, is New Zealand, Australia. Not at the moment, looks like New Zealand are far better side, obviously ranked sixth or second. But Australia are the home nation. You would hope that they would step back up. But for an Irish point of view, and this isn't being arrogant, like Scotland, our team, we're very used to, we're comfortable with. Even though it's going to be 2 years' time that it matters where you are in terms of form, Scotland have come out of a November without really getting any confidence from that, despite Gregor Townsend saying that they played well for vast majority of it. They blew a couple of opportunities to get big results. They're ranked ninth in the world. They're probably, there's not as much depth in Scottish rugby as Gregor Townsend would like. So is he able to, or is he even going to be the coach in 2 years' time, is interesting. And then, unfortunately, from a competitive point of view, realistically, the band 3 and band 4 teams, from 13 onwards, they shouldn't be competitive at all. So it's really a case of how that draw worked out, what side of the draw you were on. And for us, following the rankings, we played Georgia in the last 16 game. And they're ranked 17 in the world. They're finding it difficult to get back to the level they were at a couple of World Cups ago. And then we would play Argentina in a quarter final, and then we would play England in the semi final if we were lucky enough to get through that. Whereas you say, like, the rankings haven't done New Zealand and South Africa any favours. They're ranked 1 and 2 in the world, and you would be shocked if they don't run into each other in a quarter final. So all it meant was that it was completely random. After, you just need to be in the top 6 or 7-12, etc. But your placing in that didn't really matter. And it was look at a draw. We were on the right-hand side and avoiding New Zealand and South Africa, who were 1 and 2. And hopefully we can be in a good place and do something special.
And Johnny, I suppose the caveat to all of that, the asterisk beside it, is coming into the 2019 World Cup, we were absolutely delighted with the draw we had. And we were mapping out our potential route along the World Cup. You have to go, and you have to actually go and win those games.
Yeah, you do. And I think, you know, I've already seen, you know, on social media, and I've probably said it myself, like, oh, who will Ireland get in the quarterfinal? And, like, wait for the Scottish to be listening to more and more of that for the next 2 years, because it's going to be massive. Like, I agree with Bernard, you know, there's nothing there that should worry Ireland, but that doesn't mean, you know, that things can't happen. So Scotland could easily have a game plan that will upset Ireland, and obviously the next 2 years are going to be important in that. But, like, you can't just say, oh, who are we playing in the quarterfinal? And then people thinking that might be the easier side of the draw in the quarterfinal that you'd like, but Argentina are World Cup animals. Like, you know, we haven't done very well against them in World Cups either. So my first reaction this morning was like, oof, tough way to get past the quarterfinal, you know, even though quarterfinal is not where their eyes are going to be set. But for all the rest of us, and you're listening to the narrative all the time, you know, how are we going to get past the quarterfinal with a proper opportunity to go deep into a World Cup? And Argentina does not feel like the pathway to success, does it? They've got serious depth. It's not even their depth, it's their system. I think they just keep spitting out more players that you may not have heard of, but they play so such good attack in rugby, nice and square, balls off their shoulder. They're really good that way. And Ireland will be up against it. You know, they'll have a big scrum, they'll have a good set piece. They'll be quite good by the time you get there, you know. So, but then at the same time, you know, as far as it goes, you could be against France or you could be against one of the top nations in the world in a quarterfinal, which we've done in the past, and that hasn't worked out either. So certainly wouldn't be given out about that draw. But you know, I'd say there'll be a lot of expectations being managed in the next 2 years.
There are like the pool stages do relatively look like a formality. Maybe you're just shuffling about who finishes first and second across them. There is a potentially really interesting round of 16 game between pretty much France and one of Ireland or Scotland, which is set up to be fascinating. As we said, you know, you absolutely have to go and top this pool because it's the difference between probably playing like a USA or a Georgia or a Chile or a France in a round of 16 game.
Yeah, like France is the one you don't want to run into there. Like New Zealand will probably play Spain. South Africa will play Tonga. Fiji will play Wales. That's obviously they're probably the closest match if Wales can get a bit of form. And then Australia will play Japan. England will play Italy. Argentina will play Chile. And Ireland will play Georgia if rankings follow through. So to be flown across or to swing over to the other side of the draw and run into France in a last 16 game would be a very, very difficult game. Having said that, if you won that, you would play the winner of Fiji and Wales, which is the softest looking quarterfinal. But I think you'd want to stay on the right-hand side of the draw if you're Andy Farrell. And absolutely, Argentina are a fabulous side, and they're top six in the world at the moment. They're sixth in the world in the rankings, potentially playing a bit better than that, to be honest. But as I said, I think at the moment, the teams you don't want to play are England, France, South Africa, or New Zealand. They're the four you want to try and avoid, and we have avoided them at the moment.
The other interesting part as well is when we're mapping all this out, and I've been very guilty of saying it as well this morning, New Zealand and South Africa are on the other side of the draw if you can top Ireland's pool. Is there potentially, you're probably looking at New Zealand, Australia being the opening game of the tournament. Host Australia, big game. I think it's going to be in Perth, the opening match. Like, talk about a prime opportunity for Australia to come in and potentially shake up the entire format of the tournament.
Yes, we've seen them come from nowhere and get their game together for the Lions. Obviously, post Lions, and particularly the November tour has been really poor for them. But there is some talent there. There's some talent there now. And it will be, I think the fixture is going to be out in the February 26th. I'd be shocked if that's not the opening game of the World Cup. And Australia are well capable of pulling off a shock. But I still think there's some. They could be a lot better and still finish second in that group, if that makes sense. I think the All Blacks still have plenty of road for improvement. And I think even though Australia will be better in the World Cup, I expect them to finish second.
Jody, who in this, and in any of the pools, do you think is most likely to have a chance at just completely shaking up the order of the tournament and disrupting everyone's best laid plans?
I just think Wales are coming in, obviously, at rock bottom. And, you know, they haven't, they've done all right in previous World Cups. I just wonder, is 2 years enough time for them to get their act together? Because I know they looked like they were getting it together, and South Africa absolutely paces them. Like, you know, that's, I know you'll go on to some aspects of that in a minute, but I just wonder, like, is it enough time? Because, you know, Wales have talent and they have players, and yeah, the system and the structure isn't great, and they've let it kind of fall apart. But I wonder, is that enough time for them to go and because you were saying there, if Ireland, or sorry, Birch was it, was saying if you go and come second in the pool, which we don't predict, and can get over France, and all of a sudden you're facing someone like Wales on the other side, you just wonder, like, do they have something in them that, you know, they can get it back together within the next 2 years? That's the one I'd be querying.
Yeah, sure. We'll find out in 2 years' time. We'll be talking about it between now and then. You mentioned South Africa, obviously, and Wales at the weekend, Johnny, and talk about a hammering. If ever there was a case to be made for getting rid of out-of-window internationals, that was it. But obviously the big talking point, and of all the times for it to happen, what, 5 minutes, 7 minutes from the end when you're 70 plus points ahead, or 2 minutes from the end when you're 73-0 ahead or something, wasn't it? Even Etzebeth's red card burners. About as mindless a thing as I've seen on a rugby pitch in a long time, particularly given the context of scoreline and time in the match as well. We're obviously going to find out in the next, probably today, I'd say.
No, there's been a delay. So effectively, there was a 5 or 6 hour hearing yesterday, and the decision was expected this morning. But apparently the committee can't actually agree upon the sentence. So I think they're saying now maybe Saturday or Sunday, which I don't know what you would take from that if you're Estebeth, in terms of, is that is it going to be more lenient or more serious? I thought he'd get around 24 weeks. I think it has to be a big ban. I mean, it's the most clear cut gouge I think we've seen in a long time. You know, we've seen other gouges where the hand is across the face, and whereas this looks like he's just literally trying to put his thumb in Alex Mann's eye. And I know there's evidence of a little bit of a scuffle at a previous rook and potentially hand across the face, but when you're 140 capper like he is, and there should be no bad blood between him and Alex Mann. Mm-hmm. The game was won. It's very unusual for a player. He's never been sent off in a test match. Mm-hmm. And to be fair to him, like, he is one of the most physical, abrasive locks in the world. So I think he deserves massive credit for the discipline he's shown. Now, he's been in club games and stuff. He's had some ill discipline, but at a test level, he's actually stayed on the right side of the law more often than not. But here he's completely lost the plot, and it's a foul act. And I think World Rugby now need to throw the book at him. And I imagine that's what's going to happen. Is it going to affect his Rugby Championship or the Nations Cup next year? Probably not. I think it's the Sharks who are going to suffer.
Yeah.
Ironically, long term, a bit of a rest like that could be good for him and South Africa into the next World Cup. You know, he's got a lot of miles on the clock, obviously. Has played in Toulon as well and been around. But yeah, he's going to get a big ban, and that's one of the most cowardly acts, gouging, and it'll have to be severely punished. If it's not severely punished, I think World Rugby need to have a look at themselves.
And Johnny, I'd be curious to see how coaches and players are reacting to this, because it's one thing that's driven me bananas watching rugby over the last few years, because we see so few kind of punch ups and real old school kind of dust ups on the pitch anymore. It is creeping into the game, this hand into the face. I'm not actually going to eye gouge you, but I'm going to put my hand quite near to your eye, and you know, just close enough to it that it's going to agitate you enough, and it's going to look bad, but it's not quite an eye gouge. And I think we've been treading a line on this for a real long time. And to be honest, I'm not disappointed to see someone now is actually going to take the rap for it.
No, I think, you know, Bernard, when you're saying that, you know, there's a delay, maybe there's an aspect that someone wants to throw the book at him completely and people are trying to talk him down. You know, I don't know what that would mean either, but, you know, maybe there is someone wanting to do a kneel on it and get him out of there for quite a long time. But, like, my biggest thing was I was just so disappointed. Like, I like when the top players are the top players and they're fully respected and valued for what they are. I don't want anyone's career to be tarnished by something like this. So I was just really disappointed by someone with, you know, that many caps. I'm sure he'd worry about me, like, but, you know, just completely disappointed to ruin a career like that. Because, yeah, there's the aspect I've seen of doing the rounds, like, you know, he'll get a rest and maybe he'll be better for it in the long term. Respectfully, he won't be, because look at what's gone across his career now in his name. You know, that's a horrible act. And I wonder sometimes, he's so big and abrasive and strong, like Bernard said, what are you putting your hand in someone's face for? Like, grab him, throw him around the place, punch him if you want to. I'd respect him a lot more. But like, what has frustrated him so much that he wants to put his... And yeah, yes, there was a hand in his face at some stage. I don't think it was anywhere near what he's done. So like, what's the need for, you know, the reaction like that, oh, I'll get you back with my hand in your face. Like, how childish is that? Like, you know, so just really disappointed. It's such a poor act from him. And I'm sure it had been sleepless nights based on what's going to happen to his name and his reputation afterwards. But it's an awful act.
Can I just say, I think players like Estebet and Bakis Bota and Pascal Pape and these fellas back in the past, like, they are the enforcer in the team as such, right? And we value them. We pay them a lot of money and people look for them and they ask them to go out and do that every week. And even James Ryan for Ireland is that type of player, and that probably fed into his red card. So it's a very fine line between being violent, okay, and stepping over the line. Now, often that comes with a clean out or a tackle or a big ball carry or whatever. Whereas, unfortunately, when it becomes a gouge, it's completely unacceptable. And the player that you admire for what they bring, you have to then, I suppose, criticize them and they go down in your estimation. But unfortunately, it's a very difficult place to get to be that enforcer. To want to imp- or how would you say want to hurt people, right? And then not across the line. I'm not forgiving them. I'm just saying it's that tiny percentage. And what I culturally, for me, I couldn't believe when I went to France how culturally acceptable gouging is. Like I remember team talks where our DOR and our captain would be talking about using the fourchette, they call it, the fork, basically, you know, to show that you're up for the game and physically intimidating or whatever. And it, thankfully, it's decreasing in terms of that. But it's probably, I'm not saying it's part of South African culture or anything like that, but I'm just saying is that it's a horrific act. It's probably the most cowardly act you could do on a rugby field. Probably biting is probably the equal to it. And when you have, there's so many situations where players can use mitigating factors or lack of intent for a gouge and get off. I think this one here, unfortunately for Estebet, is a very difficult one to mitigate. And that's why World Rugby need to send a message that it's not going to be tolerated.
Yeah. So go ahead.
Just on that, I think it's very hard for those physical players, like Bernard said, to actually release that frustration. If you can't get the guy in a tackle, you know, you can't actually punch a guy anymore. It is a red card. So, you know, it's only so hard you can push a guy, you know, before you get any frustration out. And you often see the kind of the jabs with a jersey in a hand and they're trying to get him in the chin. There's not much satisfaction from that either. Like, so maybe it's just this kind of pent up frustration. I can't do a whole lot. But like, I think putting a hand in the face is certainly not the way to deal with it. There's no real way to do it anymore unless you can get the guy in a contact, which at this stage, it's very hard as well to not cross the line on that when you're physically over the top. Like, so I reckon there's a lot of frustration in what happened, but that's just not the way to go in summary, is it?
Yeah. And we'll find out what the ban is in the next few days. Finally, on the international stuff, and it relates to Connacht, obviously, but Mac Hansen has gone for foot surgery this week. John Muldoon was doing a press conference for Connacht yesterday. He said literally Hansen was just out of surgery that afternoon, so they couldn't put a timeline on it. But he did say it's not going to be a case of weeks. You're talking medium term at the very least here. And reading between the lines, it sounds like they didn't even really know what it was that he was getting operated on, because it's this foot injury that has recurred from the Lions. And then he obviously did it against the Bulls when he came back for Connacht and has re-injured it against South Africa a few weeks ago. So it sounds like it was almost an exploratory surgery as much as anything. Either way, looks now like he's going to be a real doubt for the start of the Six Nations at the very least, possibly even the whole thing.
Yeah, so what is it now? It's less than 8 weeks, 7 weeks to that France game. You would imagine he's unlikely to be fit for that. The fact that it's a recurring injury would obviously mean that they're going to be a little bit more cautious with it in terms of surgery. It sounds like a metatarsal. Do you remember
David Beckham
was made of him?
The metatarsal was invented, I think, in 2002.
No one had heard of it before till then. But unfortunately, it's not a common injury, but we've seen instances of it. And it's quite a tricky one to get right. So, look, he's going to get great medical care. He posted on Instagram this morning, he's out of hospital and he's starting his rehab already. But yeah, from an Irish point of view, he was one of the bright sparks of November, obviously playing in a new role. But his aerial ability, given the way the aerial game has become so important, is massive. And the only good thing is Hugh Keenan, my understanding, is due back very close to the Six Nations. So hopefully we were able to place him with Hugh Keenan. But yeah, in terms of the Irish squad depth, Mac Hansen's a fella Andy Farrell will hope gets back for some part of the Six Nations.
And Johnny, the real frustration on his part is obviously he has been dealing with this issue since the summer and it's been an on and off thing. But every time he has come back, he hasn't needed a big lead in of game time to get himself back up to speed. He played very well in that one game for Connacht against the Bulls and he was out for another few weeks. Came back in against Australia and scored the hat-trick. I know, as John Muldoon said, maybe he could have run in those three tries from the distance they were all out as well. But either way, he was outstanding in that game as well. He hasn't needed a big lead in to get back up to full speed. And I think that's where the real frustration comes from.
Yeah, I think the frustration as well is just seeing how good he can be in such short, like, windows and space of time. What would he do if he could string a few games together at the moment, you know? So I'm sure from a coaching perspective, you miss guys like Mac Hansen with personality around the camp. He's also a free spirit. So, like, maybe he just doesn't worry too much about not putting words into his kind of psyche, but you know, he just comes back and does his thing, and it's refreshing, actually, you know. But the part I was thinking when I was looking at some of the games across the weekend and maybe the lack of opportunity, but and maybe Hugo Keenan comes back in and the space is gone, but like Rob Balakoon, is there a spot for him to come back in? Because like, I don't know how much he's done wrong to be completely out of that Irish setup. Obviously, injuries and stuff like that, but he's electric. He's got pace, power, a nose for the finishing line. Like, you know, what does he need to do now to get back into a training camp and properly go at it? Obviously, after the A game as well, surely there's an opportunity for him as a finisher.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll wait and see. And as Bernard said, Hugo Keenan due to be back in the new year as well.
Could go I just ahead. Say something on yeah, Mac Anson? And it's just something I heard last week. So England are going very well, very impressive in November. I think they're 11 from 12 in 25. But a big part of that is their ability to dominate the aerial game and then hurt teams quickly on kicks that they've caught on their own kick. And just looking at what Mac Hansen did for Ireland in November. So Bortwick apparently has a stat that for every contestable that you catch, that you've kicked, increased your chance of winning a test match by 5%. Now, whether that's accurate or not, apparently this is what he preaches. The players believe in that now, and they've kind of tailored their game to try and exploit that. So, example, if you catch three against the grain, that increased your chance by 15%. Now, I don't know what is that tier 1 v tier 2, etc. But it shows you, even if it's only half right, it shows you the impact of that aerial game is having now at a high level test rugby. And Ireland are going to have to be better, are going to have to be very, very good in that area, I think, given the fact of our lack of power and size elsewhere.
On the provincial scene then, URC last weekend, Leinster battle past the Dragons, Munster slipped up for the first time this season, let a big lead slip against the Stormers. Ulster breeze past Benetton and Connacht had an important win against the Sharks. This week we're on to Europe though. Leinster and Munster in the Champions Cup. Connacht and Ulster in the Challenge Cup. I'm going to start here with Leinster. They face Harlequins this Saturday at 5:30 p.m. in the Aviva. That's in Pool 3. And I want to talk about Jacques Nienaber first. Being in the news lately after that interview he gave to Super Sport in the week of the Ireland-South Africa game, he said he misses South Africa, left the door ajar for a potential return to the box for the World Cup after his contract with Leinster expires in 2027. That wasn't received very well on these shores. So he was asked further about it this week, spoke at length about it. But here's a little clip of him now just justifying the comments and essentially saying they were taken out of context at the time.
No, I said my contract with Leinster is until the end of this 2027 season. So that's when my contract finished, which is a fact. And I think it's common knowledge. I think it's in the public domain. Everybody knows that. Yeah. And then the question was, so what then? So I said, and that's where the Anthony story come up. I said, then I don't know. I can't tell you what happens then. And that is what I said. Listen, I don't know. I literally, if I'm, I don't know, I can't tell you what's going to happen after that. I know that I'm the sole provider of my family. So if my contract expires with Leinster, which I enjoy working with, which I love, that's why I extended my contract. But if my contract finished on whenever it's July, June or July 2027, whatever then is up, that's the best for me to provide for my family and that suits my family, I will definitely look at that because I have to provide for my family. There's nobody else that provides for my family. My wife's not working. She can't work as a physio in Ireland because it's a job that is, there's enough physios here. So it's on the red list or whatever they call it. She can't, she's just a dependent on me. My two kids are studying, they're not working. So I must actually get a job. So hopefully I get a job after my contract expires with Leinster.
Bernard, you have thoughts on how this has all played out.
Sorry for him. I don't think he's done anything wrong in any way. And I think it's quite a negative take to be criticising him for what he said because he was interviewed by South African TV. He didn't knock Leinster, didn't slag off Irish rugby in any way. In actual fact, the fact, as he said himself, he's re-signed here to 2027. And he was asked about, and he spoke about life potentially after 2027. And the coaching world is very risky. It's nomadic. I don't think he has to worry about it getting a job after 2027. He is one of the best coaches in the world. He may end up like, look, let's put yourself in his shoes. He's South African. He's been involved in two World Cup wins. He's off contract, whatever, 3 months before the third, a chance of a third World Cup. He's highly, highly respected by the Springbok players. He's obviously highly respected by Razzie. Razzie and him are very close. there potentially is, if Leinster don't recontract him or if he decides at the end of that contract to go back to Springboks and be part of a third World Cup. I mean, who would turn that down? Okay, and he's not saying he's going to do that. He just obviously hypothesized around his availability. There's also the chance that, like, don't forget the Pat Lam clause. Like, a lot of Irish coaches, and I'm not sure what Jack's situation is, have a 6-month clause in their contract. So even if your contract is 2027, if the powers that be want to get rid of you, and I'm not saying this is for Jack, but this is a factor for a lot of Irish professional coaches, is that there's a 6-month clause that they can give you 6 months notice, which means 6 months pay, right? So the contract that you have, which you think gives you 2 year security, actually only has 6 months security in that case. So I think he's unbelievable. The problem is that I think people are looking to find a reason why Leinster are underperforming, and the easy guy to blame is Jack Nienaber. Whereas having spoken to a lot of Leinster players, they're in awe of him. Like, they love working with him. They believe in his methods. And they're no fools. These lads have been exposed to, like, lots of good coaches. Most of them are British and Irish lines. So that's all you need to know. You know, and a guy, if Cherry Flannery or Felix Jones did an interview with RT or Ron Nagar or Dunica Ryan and said, look, at the end of their contract, would they be interested in coming home? I don't think anyone would say, oh, they should be sacked them. You know, sacked them to get them out of Irish rugby. Get them out of French rugby or Springbok rugby. No, they're there doing their job. They're committed to it. I think it's potentially, everyone's entitled to their opinion. I think he's been hard done by to be criticised for what he said. Maybe taken out of context. Maybe it was the fact that we got beaten by South Africa. And suddenly he becomes the fall guy. I don't think he's the fall guy in any way, and he's just doing his job. And as I said, he's committed to Irish rugby, and he hasn't criticised Irish rugby in any way, Irish Leinster rugby in any way.
Any thoughts, Johnny?
Yeah, I think he's just been honest. Like, what, we're going to kill a guy now for being honest? And he answered the question properly in the first place. I know he's been chased around about what he actually said. Like, you can go back to, you know, I'm committed to where I am, blah, 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 no answer, move on. And that's brutal to listen to. So he's been honest in an interview, and then he's been asked a load more times about what he said and being criticised about it. Like, I don't really understand that. We want people to be themselves, and then we go chase them about it. But the other side of it is I know factually he's how committed he is to Leinster rugby and making their system all work. Like, he's gone down to underage pathway coaches in Leinster and given them hours of his time to make sure that their defensive system is going to feed eventually into his defensive system, and the commitment to, you know, the hard press, so to speak, in Leinster rugby is there for the next while, like, not just for a year that Jack hangs on for, you know what I mean? So I can't understand a guy who commits his life, and when Jack does something, he commits his life to it, like, you know. So I can't understand why we criticize a guy. And as Bernard said, like, people want to blame Leinster's shortcomings on the fact that they're defensively more aware, you know, because the attack maybe has taken less time in training. That's all, you know, for other people to speak about. I don't know the facts of that, but what does it matter? There's two sides of the ball, and they're working very heavily on one. And the side of the ball that he's working on is actually what wins the championships anyway, like, you know. So his strength shouldn't become an issue for people when they don't win big trophies. And then him being honest in an interview is not something to chase him around about. I think that's quite frustrating for people involved.
Yeah, and a lot of coaches don't lie straight in the bed, you know, when they're talking to the press. So I even remember when Razzie was in Munster, it was pretty common knowledge he was going back. And look, he did what he had to do at the time. But for quite a while, he was adamant there was no story there, you know. And so I think what Jack has done, he's been incredibly honest. Now he's getting vilified for it. And the people who are annoyed with the way Leinster are playing and are using that as a stick to beat Jack was hired to come in
to do that,
like, so he hasn't, like, if Leinster didn't want the Jack Nienaber defense, don't hire Jack Nienaber, you know, because that's how he hasn't changed or become a chameleon. This is what he does. He's done it all his life. He does it very well. So if you don't like it, don't blame Jack Nienaber, because he's just doing what he does and what he knows.
Is it just kind of another example of how we all kind of have lost the run of ourselves a little bit in the 10, 11 days post that South Africa game?
Yeah, totally. Totally we have. It's like
the South African fans are 100% right. Razzie has got in our heads.
Yeah, I think he has. But, like, unfortunately, the South African game, probably was the tipping point in terms of us realizing that maybe things aren't as rosy as we thought. Like we loved the praise, we loved talking about our pathways and our system and Leinster and Ireland and cohesion and all that stuff. But the reality is probably since the Rugby World Cup, even if we won the Six Nations, there's just been a slow decline or lack of fear. And even the two teams that are, like the fact that we now have two teams in the Champions Cup instead of four is another example of that. The fact that our 20s haven't been as good over the last couple of years, the fact that Ireland are dropping down the rankings, only slightly, but are dropping down the rankings, and you would say they could drop further. But it's not South Africa's fault. You know, like, the All Blacks, you could argue, said that message just as much, but we didn't want to hear it because we felt that it was going to be the last game we were going to peak. So I think they're in our head, but that's irrelevant for what's in the fans' head or pundits' head. It's what is in Leo Cullen, Stuart Lancaster, Richie Murphy, Clayton McMillan, and Andy Farrell. David Humphrey. Sorry, they're the six that have the biggest responsibility or opportunity or challenge to fix it.
So Leinster have Harlequins at home this weekend in the first game of their pool in the Champions Cup. Leicester Tigers away next week, and then La Rochelle and Bayonne in the new year. Munster of Bath away from home this weekend, and an encounter with their former head coach Johan van Grand as well. Johnny, the Stormers game at the weekend, just an incredibly frustrating one. My 4-year-old nephew was actually at his first. It was his first Munster game on Saturday. It's important to teach kids disappointment at an early age. Sure. Really hard in a good young sports fan. But look, 21-6 up at halftime, lose 27-21. Like, it's obviously not the end of the world, but it just feels like they've just kind of handed back one of the good wins they had in that opening block of matches.
Yeah, it was quite frustrating, I think, like, especially how they started and the team laid out. Like, when you looked at the team on paper, I don't think anyone actually expected even Tadhg Byrne to play, you know, fellas like that. Like, whatever about Jack coming back in, had a lot of involvements, but not a lot of minutes, or sorry, not as much minutes as he'd like across November. So, you know, seeing the team on paper, you were thinking, oh, drive on into the European competition, and then going up with three tries. And actually what I thought was very interesting was their ability off set piece. You know, I know they put a lot of effort into it, and Mike Prendergast is very into the intricacies of what they do in their attack at Bossy Lawler. But, you know, when you score like that off set piece, it's very powerful. You know, they had a two-phase play for Tadhg Byrne to stroll in, and it was a tap penalty, but it was an intricate one where John Hodnett finished. And then they obviously did a bit of an analysis for Tom Farrell to duck back inside and Craig Casey upfield. And all that stuff is really, you know, it's really nice to watch and really satisfying off the training ground. And then to give the lead away, but also it was a set piece that gave the game away, wasn't it? The Jack Crowley pullback, and is it Nell went through the middle. He just didn't respect what was happening on the front line and took the ball back, you know. So quite frustrating that something they thought they were going to launch, like their first three tries, they ended up losing the game with. And then further opportunities to get the game back. And obviously they did score, but it was a slight knock-on. So I'm sure they'll be very frustrated. But maybe it's just a little bit of fuel they need to go over to Bath. And they're up against it. Like, you know, there's no point in hiding from that. They are up against the quality over there. And obviously head coach, history and everything else. Bath top of the table today. So they're up against it. Maybe it'll give them that Munster bite in Europe that they need to go and get a job done.
Yeah, Bernard, I think when it comes to Europe, maybe not last year, well, potentially, but I think there have been a few years recently where Munster have had favourable enough pool draws in Europe and haven't quite made the most of them. They've qualified, but only just, and they've left some poor defeats back there. If you look at this pool this time round, Gloucester and Cass at home, okay, they should be expecting themselves to win those, but their two toughest teams they're going to play are both away from home, starting with Bath this weekend, Toulon away in the new year as well. It is a tough pool that they're facing into this year.
Yeah, it's a tough pool. The two away games are tough. I think they'll win their two home games. But particularly where Munster got exposed at the weekend, the scrum, both Toulon and Bath have very, very good, very good scrums.
And potentially Thomas Dutoy.
But they have the beauty of Bath is they managed to get unbelievable depth despite a very tight salary cap. Like they have... they have strength and depth in nearly every position. They've got some very good young players coming through their academy. They've won, obviously won a Premiership and a Challenge Cup last year. They're high in confidence. There's a real good vibe there. The rec is booming. They've got planning permission to extend it. So there's so much positive about Bath now. And Toulon also are a team, I think, back on the up. They're not the best team in France by any manner of means, but they're on the right track and have recruited very well. Have two brilliant tight heads in Gigi Ashvili and Sinclair. And yeah, big aggressive front five. And to be fair to Munster, in terms of tactics, technique, philosophy, I think they had a good plan against Stormers, but they had no bench. They didn't have the bench impact that the Stormers were able to bring on. And when you look at Toulon and you look at Bath, that's their point of difference. They have 30 players who can go on and compete at the top level, whereas I think Munster at the moment, you're seeing that there's deficiencies there through injury, obviously exposing that, but particularly in the front row, you know, it's no surprise that they've gone for Marcel Vandermeer from the Scarlets. They want to get a scrummage and hooker. They've obviously been allowed bringing
that a concrete link, Vandermeer from Scarlets.
I think it's done. Yeah, I think it's done now. He's highly sought after. I mean, Gloucester and Saracens want him, but my understanding is that he's going to come to Munster next year, and he's a good get. Like, he's a very good get, and that will help their props. You know, obviously they've got permission for a foreign tight head. Alatoa's come in short term. We'd see where that ends up. But like, I felt sorry for Ronan Fox the other night. Like, he's a young tight head that has loads of potential, but he's coming on to a scrum that is obviously struggling at the time, and he gets his wings. You know, Ollie Keble's coming on for them, a vastly experienced loose head, and just the power they were able to bring on six players at the same time was a real flex from the Stormers. And you know, just you felt as soon as they came on, the whole momentum swung. I know Munster had to try this aloud, but it was kind of against the run of play. The Stormers were starting to dominate set piece, dominate collisions. So unfortunately, as I said, the weakness that Munster have, it looks like Bath and Toulon are two teams who have the power and strength to expose that weakness.
It'll be, I presume, this week or next week when we see him in action. You mentioned Alatoa, though, as a bridge option to getting someone more permanent in the summer. How do you feel about that signing?
Look, I think he's a hell of a nice fella. Well-regarded in Leinster, really good pro. Has obviously experience of European rugby through Leinster and experience of top 14 and European rugby from a Claremont point of view, test rugby. It takes a lot of boxes. Unfortunately for me, he's not that out-and-out scrummage and tight head that I think Munster will need to get. But as a short-term hire, I'd always prefer to have somebody. Like, I remember in France bringing fellas from Super Rugby in. You nearly had to wait 6 months for him to adapt to European-style set piece. So you don't have to worry about that with him. So I think he'd hit the ground running and will make them better. Obviously, it's disappointing and worrying for Ollie Jager, his injury. I hope he can get back. Roman Salanoa is still in a kind of a rehab mode. So John Ryan and Fox are doing the best they can, but they need another body in there.
To wrap things up, apologies to Connacht and Ulster fans. We're not going to get too much time in you today, but Connacht face Ospreys on Sunday in the Challenge Cup. John Muldoon indicated they're pretty likely to be rotating over the next couple of weeks, and why wouldn't they? Big win last weekend, though, Johnny, 44-17 against the Sharks. And that was one they badly needed after they let some winnable games go in the first block.
Yeah, and they were impressive as well. Like, they played a lot of good rugby, but, you know, having their two tens on the pitch, so to speak, with Sean Octon at 15 and Josh Uane, you know, coming good as well, you know, footwork in the middle of the pitch and kind of letting fellas play rugby outside them in space. Like, I think it's been effective, but I think they're handling has been impressive. You see what they did in the 22. I think the Sharks were poor in defence, though, weren't they? Like, you know, you look at Paul Boyle's try, and it just all seems very easy for a South African side not to defend that. But they've got a lot going on. Like, Hugh Gavin's first try, was it, in a senior jersey? So, well worked set piece as well. So, yeah, it was a very good win, to be fair to them. They've a lot of positives coming out of it, but I wouldn't expect that to be the standard. Maybe, you know, they'll see that in the next couple of weeks, Ospreys and all the rest of it, but that wouldn't be the standard that we'd expect from even URC teams, you know. So they will be challenged a bit more, but it's nice to get one of those wins under your belt.
and we'll see a bit more of Sam Gilbert in the saddle over the next couple of weeks as well. Came off the bench at the weekend. He was joking yesterday. He did media yesterday. He was saying the biggest difference he's realised is there's a roof over the Forsyth Bar Stadium in Dunedin where he was playing in Super Rugby, and there certainly isn't one in the sports grounds.
Well, the sports grounds is a lot better, but it definitely hasn't got a roof yet. He's a good signing. Like, I think, you know, let's be honest, Connacht up till now, bar when they went to sign Bundy, they've been kind of operating a little bit in that middle range of non-Irish qualified. You know, they can't sign an RG Snyman or a Rico Ioane, but Gilbert, I think he's a player on the up. Very impressive for Otago this year. Obviously, goal kicks, he's versatile. It was great to see Nocton have a successful 100% goal kicking at the weekend. I think Lancaster's taken a like to him and is pushing him through. But Gilbert is a player that, you know, they need. And I think when Ioane doesn't have the goal kick, and a lot of the tactical kicking is taken off him as well, then you see him do what he really does well, which is get that back line and get that attack firing. I think, ironically, the two...
And himself and Gilbert have played together as well, so yeah, there's a nice little understanding.
Yeah, I think he'll hit the ground running. But like Ulster and Connacht were our most impressive provinces last weekend. And as Muldoon said there, they can both rotate in this Challenge Cup. So realistically, you know, you look for the Interpros at Christmas, they could be coming in absolutely firing, fresh, and we could have, you know, some cracking interprovincial games as well.
On Ulster then, Johnny, 47-13 against Benetton. They're playing Racing 92 on Friday, and more than likely a debut for Angus Bell in there as well. Do you see this Challenge Cup as one Ulster can actually have a crack off going and trying to win?
I think so. I don't know if it's insulting. I'm not sure I look at Connacht and think that they can go and win the Challenge Cup. I know that was seen as like a stepping stone for them last year, that they could have had a crack off it, and they probably let themselves down slightly.
But it does feel Connacht's kind of goals are more directed towards having a big URC season, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think Ulster definitely should have a crack off this competition. I just enjoy watching them, but also their talent is very, I wouldn't say young anymore, but it's mid-20s, like, you know, it's a very interesting place to watch, you know, what's coming through. I think, funnily enough, yeah, they won't hit the heights probably in the league and everything else, but you could get internationals coming out of Ulster very, very soon, like more of them, you know. And I'm looking at, you know, I've said it a lot in the past, but like Jude Possible, mm-hmm. was man of the match at the beginning, wasn't he? He's just so good in the middle of the field. I think having fresh centres coming through like that, Ireland need them, like when you look at the age profile of what they have in the middle of the field as well. So someone like him, but I just like when their pack gets together, you know, the Harry Sheridan, Troy under the sticks. They have a lot going on up there, and when it comes together, they could go a long way in that competition, definitely.
I was waiting to tee you up for Jude Postlewaite. I know you are. You have mentioned him plenty on the podcast down the last couple of years. I know you're a big fan. Burners, they're sitting nicely in the table. And that little game, the game in hand that they have, I think at the moment it's almost kind of suiting them, because they can just kind of sit back in the peloton when realistically they're kind of within touching distance of the top two.
Yeah, and they've been to South Africa. They have that done. So I think Richie Murphy would be delighted. There's a real spring in the step of the players. They're probably the best attacking side. I know Munster are good in attack, but I think their phase attack has been the best of any Irish province so far this season. I would agree with Johnny. I think there's some young talent now who are just coming into their own and have experience. There's a framework there for them to play. It's turned around quickly. And I think Richie Murphy deserves big credit, because like he came in, I think, was kind of on a trial, galvanised them, and then his second season started okay, but then a very poor end. But he'd already identified what he needed to do, the change he needed to make, and he's had a good long pre-season, obviously didn't have many British and Irish Lions or any, and is now reaping the benefit, signed two good players, Angus Bell and Augustus. Things are really looking up in Belfast.
Yeah, so they've got Racing 92 on Friday night. That looks like a cracking challenge.
Yeah, I think Racing will rotate. Racing are down, they're down the wrong end of the table for where they want to be, so they'll rotate, but that'll be a good game.
Yeah, looking forward to it, and particularly to see Angus Bell in an Ulster kit. That's where we'll leave it for the podcast today. Johnny, thanks a million as always. Bernard, also a reminder, Bath against Munster is the live game on RT Radio 1 this Saturday night. Michael Corcoran and Gareth Steenson will be on the microphone for that kickoff at 8 o'clock. We'll speak to you again soon.